This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
What do the Virgin Mary, vampires, and cartoon superheroes have in common? They're all part of popular spiritualities. Hello and welcome to The Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National. I'm Rachel Kahn. Last week we heard about the spirituality of Generation Y, which is eclectic and individualist. They're the generation born after 1975 who like to create their spiritual practice from what's on offer. And it's not to the religions they necessarily turn, but to popular culture. They're inspired by everything from movies to fantasy novels. And that's what my three guests this week call popular spiritualities. It's also the name of a book edited by two of them, Lynn Hume and Kathleen McPhillips. One of the other contributors is Adam Possemai, and he joins us later to tell us how superheroes relate to New Age spirituality. It's all very contentious stuff. Why would someone want to be a vampire in the first place?
At school, I found it difficult to make friends and wear trendy clothes. I didn't fit in, so you're looking for something else to be instead. I don't know. Perhaps that's why you identify with vampires, because you feel a bit of a misfit.
That's a log-on vampire from the Vampire Church chat room. More about that later. The Virgin Mary didn't originate in our popular culture, but she certainly entered into it, sometimes in surprising ways. According to Kathleen McPhillips, the Virgin's even been adopted into gay culture as a popular icon. Even so, her relevance isn't her sexual purity, but the way she appears in times of trouble. Recent apparitions like this one in Yankalilla, near Adelaide, are the focus of Kathleen's study.
We're being called to play an extraordinary role in the Australian church. And how many parishes in the world have that? We're looking at a national and even an international role for this parish. We've got people coming here who are being healed of, in some cases, of terminal diseases. We're finding people who are coming crying all the time. They walk into the church, they start crying. And we have people coming here who are saying, I want to spend my life for God because of what I've perceived and felt at Yankalilla.
Given the busloads of pilgrims to Yankalilla, it begs the question just how secular our society really is. I spoke to Kathleen McPhillips in Newcastle. Kathleen, the terms postmodern and post-Christian are used very loosely today, and I think perhaps wrongly some people think it means no more Christianity. What do they mean to you?
For me, they indicate that the second term, Christian and modern, has been seriously derailed or destabilized, rather than an after-modern or after-Christianity. I mean, I don't think there's any real sense in which we could say we are in an after-modern kind of life. All the forms of modernity that we're familiar with, like democracy, capitalism, liberalism, industrialization, and so on, are still with us.
And indeed, Christianity is still with us.
And not only still with us, but in many aspects, changing, transforming, growing, diminishing in lots of aspects. So I think these forms are very vibrant and undergoing immense change, but not after. I don't think we could say we're after Christianity or after modernity.
So when we see things like popular devotions around the miraculous appearances of the Virgin Mary in Australia today, and we'll be discussing three such cases, are we looking at the continuation of old-time religion or something new?
I think we're looking at both. There is a temporality there where we can see that the devotion to the Virgin has got a history and it does continue, but not in the same way that we would say 19th and early 20th century devotion in, say, particularly Europe, would have looked like. So there are connections, definite connections, but there are also new things about these forms or appearances or apparitions. Mary appears, but she doesn't just appear for the faithful, and she doesn't appear with her usual apocalyptic message. She's appearing for maybe different reasons.
Well, let's look at those cases. The first one, in an Anglican church in Yankalilla, which is a little town in South Australia, an apparition of the Holy Mother and Child was seen in 1994. Now, I know there's a traditional explanation for it, but how do you think it connects to what's happening in society at the time?
It's interesting when you look at Yankalilla, there are some very interesting aspects to that particular emergence of Mary and Child. First of all, she appears in the Anglican Church, which isn't the traditional site for the appearance of Mary. Usually it's a Catholic site. And the second thing is that if you look at the development of that site, so initially it was a raised plaster on the side wall of the church, which one of the parishioners looked at and saw an image of Mary and Child. It's actually only a fairly small area, surface area. Then there was a development of claims. So, for example, some people saw Joseph there, the Holy Family. A rose symbol has been seen underneath that. Somebody took a photo of a lady in white that appeared only in the photo but not in the church. And somebody has also been, one of the parishioners has been channeling Mary and also Princess Diana. So there are these sort of very new age magical elements to that apparition as well. But this particular image emerged around the same time as the publication of the Stolen Generations report. And as you know, that caused immense national trauma, and it was really a sort of national lament, I think, for the loss of those children. And one of the claims that was made about Yankalilla was that the church, the Anglican church, was built on the site of a massacre, an Aboriginal massacre, and was also a corroboree site. Now, how true those claims are, I don't think they've ever been tested. They still remain at the sort of level of popular understanding. But the emergence of the site at the same time as the National Reconciliation and Stolen Generations report, I think there's a link there. I think they're related.
Well, of course, it could also be the fact that it's the product of a bored and lonely priest who decided this was a good way to rev up business in his, you know, almost forgotten little church down there.
Possibly. I mean, maybe, but I think you can't reduce it just to that.
So it doesn't really matter, in fact, what might have started the whole thing. It clearly picked up a lot of other narratives or meanings.
And I think this is the thing about the three sites that I looked at. They all did that. They may have begun with, who knows, a particular push or a particular narrative, but they develop with pace into what I think are postmodern religious sites.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I saw that apparition, and I have to say that I wasn't totally convinced, be that as it may.
Yeah.
Sydney had its own version of a popular virgin apparition in the seaside suburb of Coogee. Can you describe what it was?
This was occurring around January 2003, which, as you know, was shortly after the first Bali bombings, in which quite a number of Australians were killed. So the apparition appeared on a fence post jutting out to sea just above the cliffs in Coogee. It was an apparition of Mary. It was first seen by a local resident, Christine Cherry, who said that she had been seeing this apparition between 3:30 p.m. and 4:15 p.m. in the afternoon every day. And it was picked up by the local media, and very shortly afterwards a crowd began to gather, and then it developed with pace until there were literally hundreds of people there. I think one of the really interesting things about this site is that Christine Cherry said that she could see the Virgin, and she nominated the person as the Virgin, although the apparition did not speak to her in any way. Christine Cherry isn't a Christian. She says she's spiritual, and I think that means New Age, but she isn't actually a Christian, although there were various people who then came to the site who were Christians and who were indicating that the Virgin was speaking to them or touching them or so and so. That particular site lasted for a few weeks. It got quite a lot of media attention. The local priest from the Catholic Church came down and said it was trickery and that people weren't to believe in it. It also happened in the summer holidays when beach going was at its height. People were coming to the site to and from the beach. The last time it was seen was, I think it was late January 2003, when someone wrapped a toilet bowl round the fence post, and after that it wasn't seen again.
Gosh, that was a real desecration,
yes,
I guess. And people must have felt that.
They did. There was quite a lot of outrage, and because Christine Cherry had, she'd actually linked that site herself with the Bali bombings. The apparition was seen almost, it was only weeks after that site had been renamed Dolphin's Point in recognition of those people in the eastern suburbs who had lost their lives in Bali. So she came up with the connection.
People on the street would have seen selling of souvenirs,
yes,
around that site, and I wonder whether that prompted, you know, some skepticism. I mean, that whole problem of merchandising the sacred, I suppose it's very much part of our contemporary world.
Absolutely. I don't think that's postmodern in any sense. I think that's really related to sort of modernity and forms of capitalism. But Christine Cherry herself set up a stall and started selling religious iconography. So, you know, I mean, I think this is one of the things about these sites is that they're polyvalent. They're mixed in not just to sort of religion, but also to other forms of social life. So we could expect to see, you know, markets set up and goods being sold and so on and so on. And there was enormous scepticism, of course. I mean, most of the media reports were quite sceptical. The parish priest was sceptical. The local council was sceptical. People who lived around, because it's such a sort of urbanised area, there were so many people living in that area, were enormously put out, you know, parking spaces couldn't be found and such and such. So, yes, I agree. I think there was a lot of scepticism, but still, it generated a lot of emotion. I think one of the functions of these sites is to try and hold together the contradictions that we are living in the modern world. And in a sense, maybe the Virgin is representing lament or mourning. I mean, the loss of so many people in one area in the eastern suburbs. I mean, how does a community deal with that?
Yes. Well, with the Rockingham Virgin in Perth, we have another manifestation of the Marian devotion, but it's certainly a very enigmatic one. Here a virgin weeps fragrant oil, not just any time, but on feast days. Do you think its appearance was also a response to a disaster, the disaster of 9/11?
I mean, that's the link I'm making. This is a fiberglass statue that a parishioner from the Rockingham Parish bought in Bangkok in, I think it must have been 2001. So in 2002, the Virgin starts weeping, this statue starts weeping this oil. That's the link I'm making with these three sites, that they are in some ways responses to these enormous national and global events that are somehow too much for us to cope with consciously. And they're expressions of excess, they're expressions of, I think, lament and mourning, and just an inability to be able to hold all of this together to understand it. And I think with Rockingham, the statue in Rockingham, I think what's really interesting there was that the church did take that on. The Archbishop instigated a formal investigation. That formal investigation involved the statue being tested scientifically. This is a fiberglass statue, so they did scans on the statue. And they also had a theologian involved, and they interviewed parishioners. So they were very sort of consistent in this investigative process. And the Archbishop came out very carefully and said that while he didn't think this was a miracle, this particular instance, it didn't mean that miracles didn't exist. After that, the parishioner who owned this statue was asked not to put it on public display again. But she took it home, and it's in her home, and now her house is a site of pilgrimage. So there are hundreds of people coming to visit this statue and see it weep in her home.
Gosh. Kathleen, I think you mentioned Princess Diana before, and I wonder whether the Virgin Mary is coming into culture as something of a female celebrity. She's kind of shedding some of her arch-traditional characteristics and coming back in this more popular way. Is that perhaps what makes her available or more attractive to a wide range of people who wouldn't necessarily call themselves Catholic?
Possibly, that could be true. I mean, I think the other thing that's happening with, if we're talking about sort of post-Christian practices, even post-religious practices, is that devotional practices of traditional churches are becoming popularized, and they can be put into all sorts of popular forms, such as, you know, comics and books and TV shows. I mean, think about a series like Buffy, you know, that had so much religious symbolism in it. So I think the realm of the popular picks up a lot. I think it looks for material far and wide, and it finds Mary, and it finds Mary very accessible, I think, because she is an enchanting symbol. She's magical. She's beyond rationality, really. I'm talking about, you know, her apparitions here. Some people see her, some people don't. And I think popular culture enjoys this very much and can make good use of it, yes.
In your studies, do you have any sense that the attraction to the Virgin Mary in a culture that is so obviously sexualized, that's so very interested in sex, do you find that her features of purity and virginity and sort of asexuality, do they have any currency in popular culture, in popular spirituality?
See, that was Marina Warner's argument, that she doesn't hold that now and that she's not really relevant in that perspective. You know, I mean, I think someone like Princess Diana has more relevance to women in that regard than Mary does.
Do you think Princess Diana has become a kind of surrogate Virgin Mary figure?
I think she's a saint. A popular saint. I don't think she's a surrogate Virgin Mary. I think she's very different to Mary in lots of ways, because she is a sexual person, and she has a sexuality, and she was married and she had children. Women today identify much more with a figure like her than they ever would with the Virgin Mary. It's interesting that the Church continues to sort of push the Virgin Mary as a sort of archetype of femininity, because she just has so few, when you look at her in that narrow sort of theological bound form, she just has really nothing to say to modern women.
So what you're really saying then is that her efficacy, her value then in all of these three cases is that she speaks to larger issues about society, about reconciliation.
Yeah. Yes, I think so. And I think she speaks contextually and specifically. So where she emerges, it depends very much where she's seen and who sees her. I think she's speaking about other things than motherhood and virginity.
Well, I'll be looking out to where she pops up next.
Right. Me too.
Kathleen McPhillips teaches humanities at the University of Western Sydney. From the Virgin to the Vampire, we're exploring popular spiritualities on the Spirit of Things here on ABC Radio National. Well, if the Virgin has a shadow side, then it's the Vampire, who comes out at night, seethes with sex, and feeds on blood.
I used to feed primarily during sexual contact. I was like a succubus. I'd go on the prowl for lovers, nearly always getting what I wanted and having to turn down 10 times as many suitors as I accepted. I would get high off their passion and sensation, leaving them drained and exhausted while I bounced off the walls.
Fact or fantasy? Are these the ravings of a wannabe vampire or the real thing? It seems the vampire legend always keeps you guessing. It's just one of the popular spiritualities on offer today, which Lynn Hume has examined. Lynn is an anthropologist and an expert in paganism, which is now among the spiritual choices we can expect people to include on the census. She's speaking to me from Brisbane.
There's a definite trend away from doctrine and dogma. People are looking for something that's individually meaningful, and they often find it in the secular and in their everyday lives, particularly with fantasy literature. So they're putting themselves in the position of characters in different types of fantasy literature and playing with that idea of being a persona from literature, from film, from comic books, as one of our contributors has discussed. And it's a world full of imagination now, and you can play out your imagination in role-playing in your mind and with like-minded others. For example, the vampire subculture that I write about, people started off with game-playing, Dungeons and Dragons, Vampire the Masquerade, looking into literature on vampires. Any kind of fantasy literature that sparks the imagination.
Now, I would have thought that researching vampires was pretty daring of you.
Well, I did most of it on the internet, so absolutely anything can be found on the internet these days, as you know. So the internet is this sort of vast space where you can be anything and become anything, and you're bound to find somebody else who thinks the same way.
Gosh, I wonder whether that makes you concerned about how valid the research data you're working with is. I mean, people do fantasize. Do you think some of the vampires you were studying might have been imagining that they were vampires?
Oh, I think there's a lot in that, yes. But there would be a core group amongst a lot of people who would just fantasize. It's easy to move from fantasizing to imagining to role-playing to dreaming out something and then to actually mythologize yourself as that thing. And a lot of people seem to be doing this. I've spoken to people in real life who think that they have an alien seed in their bodies and that they're half aliens and half humans. A lot of people might play at it or imagine, and then that gradually plays out in real life that they think they are that person.
So are you actually saying that fantasy contributes enormously to this burgeoning field of popular spiritualities?
I think that's one aspect of it. There are other aspects, as discussed by the other contributors in the book, Popular Spiritualities. I'm talking about people who read fantasy literature or see themselves as a character in a movie and play that role out.
How important is fantasy in the vampire subculture?
I think that's extremely important in the vampire subculture because a lot of it started off reading literature like Bram Stoker or Anne Rice's, more contemporary, of course, Anne Rice's vampires. So,
who are they? Which books are you referring to there?
Lestat the Vampire, Interview with a Vampire, the whole Anne Rice series, The Queen of the Damned. What? So it's a more romantic, sensual vampire than the Bram Stoker vampire.
What do they believe? Give me some kind of idea of what vampires do and how they actually behave or live out their vampire fantasy on a daily basis.
With a lot of them, you probably wouldn't even see them as being any different to anybody else, but like they don't all dress in a gothic style or wear black, but some of them do. There's a certain kind of dress that they can wear. There is catalogues of items they can buy, like false fangs. So some might really dress up like that, or the idea of discourse with other people who think that they are vampires as well is important. So talking about it with others, and the idea of blood is quite interesting.
Indeed.
Yeah, some people might think that they need to drink blood, a spoonful a week, or some people might say it's not necessary to drink blood, or some people might substitute human blood with blood that's squeezed from fresh meat. And others say, we don't drink blood, red cordial's a good substitute.
Well, some of the people you quote in your article definitely thirsted for blood, and particularly during sex. What's the connection between sex and being a vampire?
It seems to be, for some of them anyway, I think it's a bit of titillation there, that with the idea of actually drawing blood from your sexual partner. And they have donors who are willing to give blood.
What do you mean, donors willing to give blood to other vampires?
Yes.
Well, I must say, apart from anything else about drinking blood, I find the focus on it during a period when AIDS has made blood a lethal weapon rather interesting, peculiar. But is it spiritual or is it simply nihilistic?
Well, you're right. With the problem about the diseases that you can get from blood is of great concern. I would be gravely concerned at drinking anybody's blood myself. But yes, that would be a huge problem. And that's perhaps why they turn to substitutes, blood substitutes, like fresh meat from a butcher, or for the substitute of red cordial.
But is it spirituality or is it a rebellion, almost an act of nihilism?
Well, it is an act of rebellion, and it seems to me that a lot of the people who are in these groups, they probably had feelings of alienation in childhood, as some of them actually say, that they felt they didn't fit in with anybody else. So looking back now, when they've decided that they're vampires, looking back on their lives, they can mythologize what happened to them as a child, that they were outsiders because of their being vampires.
So is this really then about identity, trying to find an identity, fill it in, assert it?
I think it's about identity. I think it's about community with other like-minded people. And a lot of the popular spiritualities, I think, fall into that category of looking for an identity that draws people together. And the more they talk to one another, they're confirming their beliefs. One of the people that I quote in the book, a couple of lovers, said, oh, you're like a vampire. So she started thinking about, yes, I am vampire-like, and then you start moving into thinking in those directions.
But it seems a rather negative identity. I mean, to say I am a vampire is almost saying, you know, I'm predatory, I have a bloodlust. You know, there is some sort of intimations of violence there. Can something that negative be the basis of a spirituality?
Well, I think it's been turned into something a little bit more romantic. If you've read Bram Stoker's Dracula, the vampire comes out at night, lives in a coffin. You can't see them reflected in a mirror. Garlic will keep them away. The cross will keep them away. So it's been turned into something different, more romantic, more sensual. The vampire is seen as something exciting, good-looking, adventurous. So it's turned into something positive for the people who think they are the vampires.
What about immortality? One tends to think of the vampire as belonging to that strange class of people,
yes.
The undead.
Yes, the undead. The vampire is a liminal being, neither dead nor alive. And the people who seem to be interested in being a vampire, or just intrigued by that concept, seem to be betwixt and between. They're not really engaged in the life that most people are engaged in. They might be acting it out during the day, but they're living more in a fantasy world of being a persona.
Mm. Do they come together in rituals or festivals in a way that, say, pagans do or witches do?
I think it's a lot less organized than pagans. They don't have festivals. It seems to me that the way the pagans are organised, so that each part of the year is divided into particular festivals. Mm. Doesn't seem to me that organised.
Do they have any distinctive beliefs, apart from the fact that they believe that they are vampires?
They don't have any particular set of ideologies, it seems to me. It's sort of being created as it goes. Around particular issues like blood, it's formulated as it goes, more sort of like a fantasy role-playing.
Well, it seems that this kind of popular spirituality may be almost a reality, but perhaps not quite. I mean, it exists out there on the internet, but it may just remain a kind of fantasy.
Yes, it doesn't seem to me to be as established as the pagan groups are.
Well, before we go, I think people might want to know if vampires are, you know, a sizable group, and it sounds like they may not be, but should we be wary of women who wear black lipstick and white face powder?
I don't think so, Rachel. I think a lot of people dress with black and wear white face and dark red lipstick, and they've got no idea about vampires or have any intention of being a vampire.
Well, Lynn, have you had a real-life personal interview with a vampire?
No, I haven't. I've got nearly all of it off the net and from magazines like Bloodlust.
So it sounds like this popular spirituality is very much part and parcel of this new technological world of kind of living on the internet.
Yes, the new technology has produced all kinds of groups that are speaking to one another just over the internet, who probably never even meet face to face.
So is this about the hyper-real as opposed to maybe the spiritual? Well, I don't know if we necessarily have to contrast those ideas, but I'm beginning to think this is more about fantasy and hyper-reality.
Yes, a lot of it seems to me that it's like that. Yes, hyper-reality, fantasy, acting out fantasy. But some of it turns into a spiritual way of life that they're engaging as a substitute for religion or spirituality.
It certainly sounds like a substitute for religion and perhaps maybe even for spirituality as we've come to know it.
Yes.
Well, it's been great talking to you, Lynn. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rachel.
It's still an enigma, but I think that's the way vampires like it. That was Lynn Hume staying up late at night researching vampires. Her book is Popular Spiritualities. I don't know about you, but I'm ready for something more upbeat. I haven't seen Superman Returns yet, but I can imagine that in the audience there'd be more than just kids. According to my next guest, there's bound to be a lot of true believers tucking into their popcorn, probably a little itchy from the Superman costume they're wearing under their denims. Adam Possumi wouldn't be among the closet Supermen. His true identity will be revealed later. But he's devoted some of his sociological expertise to finding out just how profound is the attachment to comic book heroes. He's originally from Belgium and now teaches at the University of Western Sydney. Adam Possumi, welcome to The Spirit of Things.
Thank you.
Adam, we all like to have our heroes and heroines, and they've been around as long as civilization itself. Today we're talking about superheroes, which is your special interest.
One of my special interests.
Is a superhero different from a hero?
A superhero has superpowers, and those superpowers can be gained different ways. But what's important in the comics with superheroes is that those superpowers are gained in a secular fashion, and by this I mean that there's no divine intervention. So someone like Superman, for example, moved from his planet of origin to Earth, and because of the place he is, he gains superpowers. Batman seeks revenge. Spider-Man is bitten by a spider. And those events are basically secular. That is, they happen almost accidentally. And this idea behind superheroes is that almost anyone can become a superhero by being at the right place at the right time, or should I say for some, at the wrong place at the wrong time?
Well, I guess that's why they are so popular, because they appeal to every man, that inside every person lurks a superhero?
They do indeed. To express this, I created the term imaginary doxa. Doxa is based on the work of Plato, a set of beliefs that are part of common beliefs, street knowledge. And by imaginary doxa, I speak about a general desire grounded in everyday life fantasies, which has been articulated by works of fiction. So if I come back to the notion of superheroes, they bring an appeal to people in that imaginary doxa, because you can become a superhero at any time. But on top of that, superheroes have a double identity. They've got their identities as superheroes, and they have their identity as a character within a society. So to become a superhero in those works of fiction, you don't have to live your whole life and dedicate yourself to this superheroic life. And I believe that with those ideas developing in popular culture, they would have created this, what I call imaginary doxa, that is a type of desire within people, maybe to think that they can tap into the latent ability, that there's something there.
When you say a double life that may not be apparent to everyone else, you're talking about a latent power. So does this actually feed into the popular notion of the human potential movement?
I believe it does, because, as you mentioned, some of my work have been focusing on superheroes in popular culture, but I've dedicated much more of my time on New Age spiritualities. When I've studied both of them, I noticed some similarities in the way they developed. With the New Age movement, there's a strong belief that you can tap into your inner potential and develop what's inside of you. It can take many forms and it can take many levels. You can develop an awareness of what's around you, a greater intuition, some mental and spiritual abilities, or you can just do something in New Age spirituality just to heal yourself. But I notice in the way the character of the superheroes develop in popular culture and the way the ideas of the human potential develop within New Age spirituality, that there was a sense they were developing at the same time. That is, it's not a relation of cause and effect. It's just they developed almost at the same time, as if they reinforce each other.
Well, it does make me think of Luke Skywalker of Star Wars, because that character was certainly influenced by Joseph Campbell and his work on the hero. So in a way, there was a spiritual antecedent or something working there in the creation of this character. And that's probably why so many people identified with Luke Skywalker.
Yes, indeed. And there's a new phenomenon about Jediism, which is basically a spirituality created out of Star Wars.
Jediism,
yes. And that's another aspect of my work. And I've just recently published a book on religion and popular culture, in which I've analyzed some of the Star Wars fans or people who use Star Wars as part of their spirituality. And I've analyzed some of the chat rooms and discussion groups. And some of them want to develop those inner abilities, this human potential within themselves. And instead of being inspired by superheroes, as we've been speaking, they're inspired by the character of the Jedi Knight, which has some superheroes' abilities.
Indeed. In fact, I think some people put on their census, "What is your religion?" Jedi.
Indeed. In the last census, the one in 2001, there were just a bit more than 70,000 people who put Jedi or Star Wars as their religion. Of course, a large majority of them would have done this just as a joke or just to rebel a little bit against the system. But according to the president of the Australian Star Wars Appreciation Society, there will be around 5,000 people who are true hardcore believers.
And are there Jedi festivals or conferences where they come together and perhaps dress up? I mean, is this a kind of para-religion?
We have to make a difference between Star Wars fan and people who use Star Wars as a source of inspiration for their spirituality. Of course, there's an aspect of a fan of Star Wars dedicated to the stories, and maybe some of them will take a step further, using Star Wars as a source of inspiration for their spirituality. And you've got other people who I call seekers. They explore religion. And an important aspect of today's life when it comes to works of spirituality is that some people now use popular cultures to create the spirituality, and some of them use Star Wars. So those people who use Star Wars as a source of spirituality might go to those meetings, but it doesn't mean that they're developing something strong. At the moment, what's happening is that this spirituality is mainly expressed on the internet. And I believe that recently there was a meeting in the United States where they tried to decide what to do. But it's still something that's virtual. And
virtual.
Virtual, yes. And maybe it will grow into something else. It's very hard to know.
Well, I think this gets into the hyper-real, doesn't it? I mean, the whole idea that this spirituality seems to first appear on the silver screen and then gets carried on the internet puts it into a whole other realm, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And thanks for mentioning the term hyper-real, because in my work I use that term to describe those religions, which I've called hyper-real religions. And without going too much into academic details, I was just influenced by the work of Jean Baudrillard, who speaks about the world in which we live, which is saturated with images and symbols that are part of consumer culture, that are part of what comes out of the silver screen, billboards, magazines. And we are so saturated by images and symbols that we wonder, where's the true reality behind those signs? And this idea behind that is that there are new religions being created, which I've called hyper-real religions, and they're greatly inspired by works of popular culture. And we spoke about the Star Wars, but there's a new one being created on the internet at the moment, which is called Matrixism.
The Matrix.
Yes, which is based on the Matrix trilogy, on the element of the Baha'i faith. I'm not saying that from the Baha'i, I'm saying they use elements from the Baha'i faith and from psychedelic studies.
Wow, that's really interesting. What a combination. Mm. But it also raises the issue about consumable religion. Now, this may have been a part of religion since time immemorial, but it's certainly very evident now. I suppose if you're a Matrix follower, then of course you buy all the paraphernalia, and the same is true with Star Trek and all the others.
Indeed, those religions are part of consumer culture, and as I mentioned, religion has been part of consumer culture for ages. But what's very specific today is that consumer culture is now available to everyone at so many different levels. And of course, they can buy objects, but also the notion of consumerism makes reference to the notion of choice. And that's why in my book on religion and popular culture, I speak about those groups as hyper-consumerist religions, because the people who create those spiritualities for themselves by themselves can choose whatever they want. They don't have to follow a specific authority, whereas more traditional religions, I will call them hyper-consumerist religion. Less. People can still have some choice within those religions, but they follow the voice of an authority or the voice of a book.
This is a very self-focused kind of spiritual pursuit, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't have grand political visions. We don't see superheroes as revolutionaries.
Not at all. And even the great Umberto Eco, this great Italian semiologist and novelist, even wrote a great article on superheroes in comics in the 70s, and even spoke about the powers of the superheroes, wondering why do they fight against common crimes in the streets of New York or in the streets of Metropolis, and don't try to change the world, or try to be more revolutionary, or try to fight for ecological issues. Of course, there's been some exceptions, but that's the trend within superheroes. They fight for the status quo. And those new spiritualities, which I've called the hyper-real religions, are spiritualities that focus on the self. Everyone create their own spiritualities, and of course, it can change from one day to another one. And those spiritualities mainly work for the self. They don't necessarily work for a community or for a nation, which is quite different from traditional religions. But it doesn't mean that those spiritual actors are withdrawn within themselves. They might be withdrawn within themselves to create the spirituality, but some of them are also involved in other social movements. It's like in New Age spiritualities, there's a belief that because people are involved in New Age, they only withdraw within themselves. But some of them, according to the belief system, are working towards changing the planet into a better place.
Well, so far, I think we've been assuming male superheroes. But what superheroines come to mind?
Ah, there's, of course, the classic is Wonder Woman, who I believe they're making a movie, Wonder Woman. The Invisible from the Fantastic Four. But of course, there's some female superheroes, But the origins of the superhero myth, it was extremely masculine. There's no doubt about that. And now they're slowly starting to change. Even some characters that were already there in the 60s, like the Invisible from the Fantastic Four, she was quite subservient within a male group. And if you look at the graphic novels or even the recent movie, she's becoming more independent. And she has a character of her own. So there are changes in those comics as well that follow the more mainstream changes within Western societies.
I think it's been said that every generation deserves the superheroes that they get. So my question to you is all this good for spirituality? Is this good for the world?
As a sociologist, I follow what is called a Weberian perspective, which means that my work is based on trying to understand the meaning people give to their social actions. And what I'm trying to understand is to understand what people do, and especially changes within religion, which is the basis of my specialty, is to analyze all those changes that happen in religion and spirituality. And I notice that those changes are happening now. To say that it's better or worse, as a sociologist, I can't say much about that, but I don't see anything wrong at this stage. And I think that it allows people to develop their spirituality by themselves and gives them a mind that wants to inquire about things. So on a personal level, I see this as positive.
Who's your favorite superhero?
I have to admit that when I was young, I quite like reading Spider-Man. And I was happy with the way they adapted it on the big screen as well.
Do you have a Spider-Man suit?
No, but one of my colleagues offered me a Spider-Man doll, which is in my office at the moment on my bookshelf.
I think you'd look quite fetching in a Spider-Man suit.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming onto the program.
Thanks for inviting me.
Adam Possumai is one of the contributors to Popular Spiritualities, and the details of that publication will be on the website at abc.net.au/religion and click the Spirit of Things. Well, I wonder what superhero or superheroine are you in your wildest dreams? Personally, I'm hoping that not many of you are vampires. You can let us know by calling our spirit line. Come on, I dare you. In fact, if you'd like to hear an interview with a vampire or a Jedi Knight, tell us that too, and we'll track them down so we can all hear how fantasy becomes real life. Just ring the Spirit Line at 1300-889-216. That's 1300-889-216, and it's only the cost of a local call. The program this week was produced by me and Jeff Wood, with Judy Rapley as our sound engineer. Readings were by The Black Rose. Next week, we go back to the much-loved traditions and hear Seven Pearls of Wisdom from the Seven Spiritual Classics series. Over the past 7 months, we've looked at the great world traditions and heard from some of their most eloquent exponents, like Stephen Batchelor.
The Wheel of Dharma is a symbol for the teaching that the Buddha gave, and he compares it to a wheel in the sense that he sets in motion a teaching, a doctrine, a practice, one might say a culture, that is now moving through time, moving through space, and one might consider it as a metaphor for Buddhism itself, a dhammacakka, a dharma wheel, something that is always in its own process of transformation and change as it goes through different historical epochs, different cultures, and keeps moving on, fulfilling the Buddha's initial intention and communicating his teaching in different languages and different forms of practice throughout time.
That's Seven Pearls of Wisdom next week on The Spirit of Things with me, Rachel Kahn. Thank you.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.